You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Good evening, everybody. Thanks for coming tonight. I'm Ken Zimmerman. I'm the director of U.S. programs here at OSF. And in conjunction with the public health program and the women's rights program, it's a pleasure to greet you all for a topic that could not be more topical, public health in a populist moment. And I'll just say that I oversee the program that does most of the grant-making here at OSF in the United States. And I think what we've seen, frankly, in the past several weeks about the ways in which people have started to realize the significance of their rights potentially being taken away, especially around an issue as fundamental as their health care, is something in which, as this nation tries to respond to something close to unimaginable, has resonance in a very powerful way. At the same time, exactly where it goes is, of course, uncertain. So it's fantastic to have this presentation today, and I'm glad to be able to simply introduce the moderator. So Elizabeth Rosenthal goes by Libby. Thanks for having us. She's the editor-in-chief of the Kaiser Health News. Before joining Kaiser, she spent 22 years as a correspondent at the New York Times, where she authored the prize-winning healthcare reporting series, Pain Till It Hurts. She's a graduate of Stanford University and Harvard Medical School, and briefly practiced emergency medicine before converting to journalism. Her book, An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became a Business, How You Can Take It Back, will be published in April. Libby, take it away.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for coming and for coming out in what I hear is a rain. I'm really excited to be back in New York and talking about this topic, which is so near and dear to my heart. So,
could you move the microphone closer?
Is that it? Oh, yeah, there it goes. Sorry. Okay. So basically what we're going to do to begin with is we're each going to say 5 minutes or so about what interests us on this particular topic, and then we'll have a moderated discussion. I'll ask the panel a bunch of my questions, and then for the last half hour, 40 minutes or so, I'll throw it open to your questions. So. I figured, let me introduce our panel here. It's great because everyone is coming to this discussion from a slightly different perspective, and we're gonna hear lots of different concerns and hopes and aspirations for this unusual moment in time. So first, on my left is Jonathan Cullen. He's the director of the Open Society Public Health Program. He joined the Open Society in 2006 as the inaugural director of the Law and Health Initiative supporting legal strategies to safeguard the health of socially excluded people. He previously worked as a researcher with the HIV, AIDS, and Human Rights Program and Human Rights Watch, and he holds degrees from Yale, the University of Cambridge, and the University of Toronto Faculty of Law. So, thank you for having me. On my right is Chloe Cooney, who is the Director of Global Advocacy at Planned Parenthood Federation of America, where she launched and now leads Planned Parenthood's advocacy for U.S. leadership on international reproductive health and rights. Quite a task at the moment. Chloe was previously a vice president with the Endeavor Group and has also worked with the Global Business Coalition on HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis and malaria, and in the film industry. She's a graduate of Barnard College and is the wife of one of my colleagues at Kaiser Health News. So and it's her first one. Okay, so let's go. Nah Hammond, who is there, is a program officer at the Groundswell Fund, which supports the movement for reproductive justice in the U.S. She previously worked in research and communications with funders for LGBTQ issues and fears, a New York City-based organization that builds the leadership and power of LGBTQ youth of color. She's also worked with Queers for Economic Justice, Sylvia Rivera Law Project, and the Urban Justice Center. She's a graduate of NYU and an advisory board member of the Third Wave Fund. I'm going to move to the very end there. Ronald Martin is a law enforcement safety advocate with the North Carolina Harm Reduction Coalition. He's a former detective sergeant of the New York City Police Department. We were saying we are always New Yorkers, no matter how long we've not been here for. He supervised narcotics teams, advised the mayor's office, and worked with a range of law enforcement agencies. As a harm reduction advocate, he educates North Carolina police officers on needle stick and overdose prevention measures, and advocates for more dialogue between law enforcement and people who use drugs to create safer communities. As you all probably know, North Carolina is a state that did not expand the state. And it's Mark Meadows' home state. So, there you go. Finally, Greg Gonzalez is a research scholar at Yale Law School and assistant professor of epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health and co-director of Yale's Global Health Partnership. He's been a leading HIV/AIDS activist for more than 20 years, organizing with ACTA, the Treatment Action Group, Gay Men's Health Crisis, and the AIDS and Rights Alliance for Southern Africa. He was previously an Open Society Fellow and received his PhD from Yale in 2016, which is an interesting story to just last year. So I'm going to start us off just kind of giving an overview of why this panel means so much to me and why I was so interested, even though my book publishers say, don't go talk anywhere 2 weeks before your book is coming out. Now, this one I have to go to. So, you can see they make like guess that I put some propaganda out on the front desk. But anyway, this is a really important issue to me as a former Times reporter and now someone at editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News. I've been sitting in Washington, D.C. for the last 6 weeks since inauguration. Maybe it's been longer than that now. It seems like a lot longer. And I think what while I was sitting in D.C., our offices between the White House and Congress last Friday, watching the ACHA tank. And here we are. You know, here we are in a place where no one had anticipated. The GOP health plan went down in flames. Congressman Ryan says the ACA is the law of the land for the foreseeable future, although they tried to kind of backtrack on that today, but we'll see. As I said to my staff in D.C., now we all have a chance to kind of reset and rethink and maybe move forward in some ways that a week ago seemed a little more like the sky is falling and wouldn't be possible. Because I think one of the things we learned from the experience, or I learned from the experience of the last election, is that populism matters, that what people think on the ground and what their experience on the ground, and particularly with something like healthcare, which is such a personal issue, matters to everyone. And politicians manage to turn that into a right versus left issue, but it's a much more intimate issue than that, and I think what we've seen is in the campaign, the Trump candidacy and President Trump managed to harness that populism in ways that people didn't really understand to get the votes he needed to become president. But now I think what we're seeing in these town hall meetings, which I think really helped upset the hopes of the GOP in getting any of their bills passed, is that a lot of those same people are realizing, hey, you know, this promise and what he was talking about really affects me. I'm going to lose my health care, or I'm going to have my premiums or my deductibles are going up. So I think we've both seen how right-wing populism could be, or the populism, which is kind of, I want to say, party neutral on the ground, can be harnessed for ways that are not entirely honest or can be harnessed for the good. And I think that's really an important force to recognize. And I think it, to me, one of the lessons of this election, of this last election, was nobody was, the Democrats in particular weren't paying enough attention to that. So anyway, here we are talking about how populism has affected different parts of our healthcare system. I have been at my own story. I was at the New York Times for 22 years. I came to the New York Times, ironically, from practicing as an emergency medicine doctor and being a freelance writer. I came there full time to cover the effort at the Clinton effort at health reform. My assumption when I came to the Times to do that was that that would happen in a couple of years or a year, and then I would go back to being a doctor. And of course, a lot of things happened, and I never did. So I think, you know, one of the messages for me is that we all really need to think of how healthcare is a populist issue and is an issue for every person. Part of the reason it hasn't been expressed that way is because most of us and most people we know open bills at their living room. They're frustrated. They're angry. They get turned away from a treatment program. They can't get the medicines they need, and they do their best to solve that individually. And if they do, you know, they may or may not succeed. If they don't, they feel bad about themselves often and are very frustrated and get sick. If they do, they think, wow, that was a nightmare to have to do all that stuff and move on with their lives. But they have really no way to kind of, we haven't found a good way to harness that into a populist patient movement, which is, I think, what's really sorely lacking in this country right now. You know, there's a natural coalition. As I said, it's not left or right. It's people who, for whom this current health system and public health system isn't working very well. And when the Clinton health plan was being proposed, I thought that was, having worked in an emergency room, I thought that was a subset of Americans. Now I don't think the system is working very well for anyone. And I think that makes it pretty ripe for a kind of populist change. But more on that from our panelists and later. So to me, healthcare should be inherently a grassroots issue, which it kind of hasn't been. I mean, except for groups like ACT UP, when HIV/AIDS first became an issue, ACT UP did an amazing job of turning health and public health into a public issue. But you know, most of our groups are so diverse, and you know, everyone has their own disease, and we haven't figured out how to kind of unify. It's as if the condo owners don't work with the co-op owners, don't work with the renters. You know, everyone focuses on, I have migraines, or I have diabetes, or and they don't see what unifies them all, which is a health and public health system that doesn't work very well. I think, you know, now that we're at this juncture where we're not sure really if the ACA will stay or will go, I'm doing a little soapboxing here. I think it's really important for us all to keep our eyes on ways in which it is being I call it death by a thousand cuts. It's being unraveled in ways that can happen via regulatory measures or via not filling positions or non-enforcement. I think that's a big issue. You know, will the Republicans now say we're going to try and make this work, or we're going to try and make sure it doesn't work? And I think that's something we really have to keep our eyes on, because I think one thing that the ACA did, whether it stays or it goes, is that it changed the Americans' notion of who's responsible for health and what we owe people. And so I think that was the Republicans. The hardest thing about that bill is people feel like now it is our responsibility to make sure people are healthy. We didn't do it very well, perhaps, for some people under the ACA, but it is our responsibility, and that's a hard thing to go back on. Especially I was noticing, I don't know if you probably saw the article in the Times, I think it was yesterday, about how Medicaid, once a kind of niche program, now covers 70 million Americans. So that's a pretty big loading block. I don't think a lot of those people understood at the last presidential election what was at stake for their insurance. We're going to move on with the panel. I think populism, real populism, is really good for healthcare. Entering to populism is not. And I think that's our challenge going forward, is how does the populism we see from the right, which is powerful but not always honestly corralled and directed, how do you deal with that in your particular area? And how do you harness that populism that's kind of party neutral and growing up in response to the Republican efforts to repeal the ACA in positive ways? I always like and I want to end this introduction with the most interesting factoid I learned when I was researching my book. Surveys in Canada about who was the most popular Canadian in history, and I, of course, thought it was going to be like Wayne Gretzky or Justin Bieber, and it was actually the physician who started Canada's national health program. So I think whoever gets a health program done for the U.S. at public health system that really serves patients will be equally popular. So there we go. I want to turn it over to each of our panelists, Jonathan first, about what you do and how you see this the populism brewing out there affecting it.
Well, Libby, thank you very much, and thank you, everyone. Welcome to the Open Society Foundations, and thank you especially, Libby, for describing a brand of populism that many of us can get behind. I think I'm going to focus on the populism coming from the right. I think it's a very important phenomenon to try to describe and understand. And I'm glad that pets have been brought in. I want to begin my discussion of this with an observation that is not very optimistic, nor I think is it very original, which is that all over the world we are seeing ordinary people, often in a great deal of economic and social distress, embracing policies and politicians who are plainly bad for their health. And we can dismiss this as kind of reckless voting behavior, or we can attempt to really try to understand what's going on. I know that we will talk later in the panel about the epidemic of opioid dependence in the United States, but I think it's such a wonderful example of that, whereby, you know, we see that the very policies that would help communities address this epidemic, whether it's an expansion of Medicaid and drug treatment, greater regulation of industry, curbing of strike-hard law enforcement approaches, are precisely those policies that the president-elect rails against, even though in many cases those policies poll well. And the same is true outside the United States, right? So that we saw during the Brexit campaign a number of people from the Leave camp making this claim that £350 million a week in European Union dues would be spent on the National Health Service once Britain voted to leave. And this claim had immense popular appeal, but in fact, many of its most strident proponents were people who would sooner privatize the NHS than actually protect it or strengthen it. We have a third extremely dramatic example now in the Philippines, where the very communities who would benefit from evidence-based approaches to drug treatment and who are seeing more mass murders in that country than occurred during the Marcos era, are claiming that President Duterte, who is overseeing this murderous drug war, is actually making them safer and rallying behind him. So it's, you know, it's this kind of chronic pattern of people voting, getting behind politicians who plainly are not acting in their best interest when it comes to health. And it's true that one can look at that and see an opportunity, right? You can look at that optimistically and say, all right, well, what we need to do is offer those communities a more progressive alternative, harm reduction programs for communities hit by opioid dependence, strengthening the National Health Service, drug treatment in the Philippines, and hope that that will help them see that they're being sold a bill of goods by these right-wing populists. And indeed, that insight undermines much of what we're up to in the public health program and the U.S. programs and the Washington office of the Open Society Foundations is trying to kind of capitalize on that insight and offer people a more progressive alternative that might even drive a wedge between them and the populist politicians that they supported. And I think we have reason enough to believe that. Often, as you've given a great example from Canada, politicians who've embraced a real pro-health populism have become national heroes, not just, you know, elected president, but true national heroes. We've seen that in my native Canada, we've seen it in the UK, we've seen it in Germany, we've seen it in South Africa, we've seen it in Thailand, in Mexico, in Brazil. Universal health coverage is a winning populist strategy, right? I think that my optimism stops there. And the reason for that, although that is a lot of reason for optimism, granted, is that what I fear is that right-wing populists are actually tapping into something much deeper and much more elemental than what can be addressed through alternative policy prescriptions. And that it's not going to be as easy as offering these communities progressive alternatives. And here's where I think we really have to unpack what populism is and what is on offer from these right-wing politicians. And because I don't think it's just a set of policies. In fact, it's not a set of policies, and it's certainly not a coherent set of policies. What it is, first of all, I think is a profoundly anti-elitist stance, and this purported concern for so-called ordinary people, so that, for example, the Brexit vote can be cast by UKIP as a victory for real people, right? As though the 48% of people who vote against it are not real people, right? And of course, these real people, these ordinary people, these decent folk, are often contrasted with minority populations whose causes in this analysis become elite causes, politically correct causes, but not kind of ordinary causes. So to the extent that kind of populism translates into health policy, it could certainly translate into very exclusionary health policy. I think the other thing that populists are offering to people is this kind of us and them stance, right? I mean, they're offering an enemy. They're offering a deep hostility to political procedures, to the establishment, to intellectuals. They are provoking, they're offering conflict. And of course, you know, translated into health policy, I think that kind of conflictual us and them mentality is the opposite of what we need in health. It's the opposite of the social compact, right? Of the idea of solidarity, of looking out for each other. And it's also incredibly politically risky, because in a way, if you've set up this us and them battle as a populist, you can't lose, right? So when Trump Care tanks, as it did on Friday, if you're Donald Trump, you can just say, well, it's a conspiracy against me, it's elites keeping the ordinary people down, and so on and so forth, and it kind of gives you an excuse for your policy failures. I think a third thing that populists, right-wing populists, are offering people is frankly a profoundly anti-pluralistic idea that this kind of monolithic will of the people ought to prevail over liberal institutions like the courts, the media, NGOs. And I think that's partly why we're so concerned about populism at the Open Society Foundations. I'm convinced that if you took all of our strategies, which we're writing now, and put them in a word cloud, populism would just appear everywhere. And I think it's because it is, at its core, a deeply anti-pluralist idea. It goes against this idea of listening to multiple points of view and staking out a compromise. So that whatever you might think of Obamacare as health policy, and I think many of us were not such great fans of it, what you can at least say is that it was a product of democratic deliberation. It was a compromise between multiple points of view, and I think populism limits this possibility of compromise. I think it's antithetical to this idea of compromise or even to rational discourse in the first place. And then finally, and Jonathan White has made this argument, I think that most dangerously what populists are offering people is a sense of agency and a sense of control in a deeply turbulent world where people feel profoundly powerless. You know, powerless in the face of globalization, powerless in the face of neoliberalism, right? Powerless in the face of the austerity policies that were cast in Europe in response to the economic crisis, so that the motto of the Brexit referendum or the Leave camp could be take back control, right? So what we are offering you is control. Never mind whether this claim that your EU dues could be diverted back into the NHS makes any sense at all. Never mind that the European Union actually can have, you know, policies like disease surveillance that are good for public health. What we're offering you is a sense of agency, a sense of control, a conflict, an enemy. And I guess, you know, not to start us off on too dire a note, but I'm a little bit concerned that alternative policy prescriptions may not be a match for that particular offer. And I'm also concerned that that particular offer and that stance, that conflictual us and them mentality, is in many ways even worse for public health than the policies that go along with it, because they're ultimately bad for democracy, right? And here I am making an assumption that democracy is good for health, and that is something that is debatable, and maybe we should debate it, but I'm concerned about democracy. And that's how I think now about the connection between public health and populism.
Okay, well, that's dark. but perhaps realistic in words, we'll be talking a lot more about that. Okay. Chloe, you're on to talk about
trying to be
less
dark.
You want to talk about
reproductive rights advocate.
Right now, it's really easy to be positive.
Well, I come to you today with some optimism, more optimism than I thought I was going to come to you today with when we started planning this conversation. So, and I guess I'm going to think about populism in just the purest form of the word, and which is to say, I think my thought for you here is that if this were all about true populism, we would not be debating defunding Planned Parenthood. And we would not be debating restricting reproductive rights in the US or globally. In fact, we'd be doing the opposite. So I want to talk about sort of two examples of that, one in the domestic context, Planned Parenthood fight, and then one in the global context to sort of play that out. In the US context, though, just to state the obvious here, defunding Planned Parenthood is highly unpopular. It's a terrible idea. And recent polling really backs that up. The Kaiser Family Foundation just came out with a poll about 2 weeks ago, I think, that found 75% of Americans support federal funding for Planned Parenthood. And as I always like to point out, this isn't like an issue people haven't heard of. Like, this is, people have heard of it, they've thought about it, and they have concluded they support federal funding for Planned Parenthood. And that figure includes 57% of Republican women. So this is also spreading across partisan lines. And that's just one of many polls like that. This is a pretty steady figure that, if anything, we've seen increased support over the years. So defunding Planned Parenthood, which was a provision of the healthcare repeal, is not a popular idea, and it's not reflective of a populist mission project. And I think it's also important to note what we mean by defunding Planned Parenthood, just to problematize it further, because it's a little bit of a misnomer when we talk about defunding Planned Parenthood. There's no line item in the federal budget for Planned Parenthood. There's nothing that they can just strike out and say, take that out. The proposal, which was included in the failed healthcare repeal bill, would have excluded Planned Parenthood from participating in the Medicaid program. It would have blocked Planned Parenthood health centers from receiving reimbursements for delivery of healthcare to Medicaid patients. And this is the height of irony when you think back to the conservative populist movement that we saw bubble up in 2009 in the original Affordable Care Act debates and since, where we've heard so many times from opponents of the Affordable Care Act that the government should not tell Americans which doctors they can go to, which it doesn't actually. But defunding Planned Parenthood would do that. So this is not because of populism. This is because of a far-right political agenda that's exploiting broader voter anger to push a very unpopular agenda. And I think the reason I come with a little bit of optimism is I think we really saw some accountability on that over the last several months. And when you talk about a patient movement, I think one of the pieces that's been so inspiring sitting at Planned Parenthood has been seeing our patients tell their stories. And actually on Friday, I was just in the office of one member of Congress, a district office, who had been undecided about the vote as patients told their stories. Patients who were constituents told their story one after another, some extremely personal and humbling, really putting it on the line. So I think there is a patient movement underfoot. So my second sort of example is looking globally how not only are we not seeing a true populist project underway, we're actually seeing the effort to combat them. And that is to talk about the global gag rule. And this was one of the first things the president did in taking office. Who here knows about the global gag rule? Ah, you guys are an above average. I'm not surprised, but very good. So the global gag rule, I'm gonna define it anyway because it always needs to be defined because it's one of the most misdefined policies. It's also known as the Mexico City policy. It's a policy that prohibits organizations from receiving foreign assistance if they use any bit of their own money to provide any services, information, education, referrals about abortion, so basically to talk about abortion, or to advocate for the legalization of abortion in their own country. So if they use any of their own resources to essentially participate in the democratic process of their own country. And this administration went even further. This is a policy that's been ping-ponging back and forth since Reagan. President Obama rescinded it in his first week in office. So we weren't surprised to see it come back in the first week. What was noteworthy was the expansion of it. This president went so far as to expand it to all of global health, where it had been previously applying strictly to the family planning program globally. So that represented essentially a 15-fold increase on the policy. And what's really noteworthy about it this time as well is that he signed the gag rule just 2 days after the historic women's marches around the world. And it's a policy, it doesn't only impact women, but it impacts women the most. So here we were, I was in DC, at a historic level of turnout all around the country, historic levels of turnout in every state, and then all around the world, historic levels of turnout. Over 4 million people standing up, and a common refrain was, we will not be silenced. Yet silencing women is exactly what the global gag rule is trying to do. And they're doing it on our behalf as Americans. They're representing the American people as they do it. So you know what? Don't take away their rights in my name. So I think in the terms of this conversation, it's important to talk about the cost of this policy. And I'm sure we'll talk more about it throughout this panel, but it is gonna be felt in public health terms. It's gonna be felt in the public health of communities around the world. And not just women. In the past, the primary impact of the global gag rule has been loss of access to contraception, because primarily it's cut off the most qualified providers of family planning programs. And that has in turn led to increased rates of unintended pregnancy, unsafe abortion, and in many cases, increased maternal mortality. Now that we've seen the policy expanded, we expect these impacts to be exacerbated that much greater, but also limiting access to HIV services, to Zika prevention and treatment efforts, maternal and child health programs, and so much more. So it's really staggering and humbling when you think of the scope that we're anticipating. And I think that we've seen a lot of efforts at the global level to start to stand up against it, but I don't think that we can assume we can stand up against all of it and replace what is going to be lost. And the gag rule is only one piece. I think we've already seen a budget proposal that is going to do enormous damage around the world. And we're anticipating attacks on UNFPA, the UN Population Agency, which is the most vital source of contraceptive supplies around the world. So we're seeing a lot of threats to human rights at all these levels. And while they're not popular, I think it is really important to talk about, and building on what you said, that popularity should not be the arbiter of human rights. So while we do have a patient movement, I think the idea of access to healthcare is popular in its intrinsic form. That also shouldn't be the arbiter of these rights for us. So because I'm an advocate, I'll just quickly end on a call to action, which is sexual and reproductive health and rights are human rights under threat in the U.S. and around the world, and it's not because of populism. And so this is a time for action, and stepping back, looking at last Friday, the takeaway for us is our voices mattered. It did matter, and everything we have done has mattered, and we have to keep doing it, and we have to do it in lock arms with peers around the world. And I think one of the things that does give me some optimism is a rise of a global movement for our health and rights. So I'll pause there.
Thank you. Now I'm going to go a little bit. I was going to go in alphabetical order, but I'm going to change things up a little because I think that's focus is follows nicely on that. So I'm sorry. Thanks.
Great, so good evening everyone. My name is Nah Hammond and I'm a program officer with the Groundswell Fund. And for folks who are not familiar with the Groundswell Fund, we are the largest national funder of the US reproductive justice movement. And we make grants and provide capacity building support to grassroots organizations that are led by women of color, low income women, and trans people. So I'm actually really excited to join this conversation today because I actually do feel hopeful. And hopefully I can bring some of that into the conversation today. I am really excited that we're going to have a conversation about what it's going to take to defend healthcare as a human right for all people, particularly people who are facing the highest health disparities based on race, class, gender, sexuality, and immigration status. So these past few months have been very heavy for many communities, but they've also made it really clear that we are in a historic moment. How many people here have attended a march or a rally or know someone who's done that? Right. So for folks on video, the entire room almost raised their hands. So from women's marches to no ban, no walls, no raids actions, we are seeing millions of people take to the street and diverse communities come together to resist. This is actually representing one of the biggest base-building opportunities that has ever presented itself to progressive movements. And really, we have the opportunity to think about what it's going to take to engage people long-term beyond just coming to an action in issue-based work moving forward. And I'm excited to talk about what does this mean for philanthropy. I'm going to assume that people here maybe work in philanthropy too. And I think it's really important for us to realize that as much as we're in a political moment, we are also in a philanthropic moment. I think like many funders in this room, you've probably been in many conversations with other funders, having really serious conversations over the past few months. I've been in conversations where people have been asking, do we continue with business as usual? Or what do we need to rethink about what we've been doing so that we can be relevant and responsive to the grantees and the movements that we care about? So as we're seeing rising right-wing populism in the United States and growing attacks on the most vulnerable communities, including threats to public health through the shrinking of efforts to shrink Medicaid, gutting the EPA and affordable housing, we as a sector really need to think carefully about what we do now, because what we do is going to have lasting impact beyond the next 4 years, but really for decades. And thankfully, there's actually a lot that we can learn from intersectional movements like the reproductive justice movement that center a human rights framework and approach. So if you will indulge me, I want to just share three lessons from social justice movements for this moment for funders. And I'll name them now, and if we don't get to all of them, I can talk a little bit more about them. So the first is to fund organizing. The second one is to fund across issues and movements. And the third one is to fund work that challenges white supremacy. So I'll go into them a little bit now. I think it's really important in this moment for us to be thinking about funding grassroots organizing for progressive change. As Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. So with Republican control of the House, the Senate, and the executive branch, this demand right now needs to come from the people. And grassroots organizing is one way to harness that power of the people. And really, for anyone who's not familiar with grassroots organizing, it's just when ordinary people come together to gain skills and use our collective power to transform systems and conditions that shape our lives. In this country, we really haven't been able to win any large-scale social change without people exerting their people power, whether it's women protesting and marching for the right to vote, or working people and labor unions winning us the right to have a weekend and labor protections, or more recent examples of how the movement for Black Lives has really elevated a conversation about police violence and anti-Black racism in the United States. Power concedes nothing without a demand. Even in the gleeful defeat of the American Healthcare Act recently, what we saw was this was an issue that a lot of reproductive justice organizations that Groundswell supports took on and really mobilized their constituents to get involved, to attend a town hall, to call their elected officials. And what we saw was hundreds of thousands of people in blue and purple and red states calling and demanding and showing up at town halls. And the result was that Democrats and moderate Republicans ultimately were able to help this bill make sure that it did not get a vote. And we cannot underestimate in this moment the importance of organizing. The second thing that I was sharing is the imperative right now to fund across issues and movements. So the kind of mass-based organizing that can bring enough people together to actually have the power to make any social change and actually reach hearts and minds of people who may not be well-versed in an issue is the kind of organizing that cannot afford to be single-issue focused. And moreover, at Groundswell, we believe that it doesn't exist in one single sector. So for Groundswell, we've been thinking about, as a funder that cares about reproductive justice, that we are not going to be able to defend reproductive justice in the current climate by just funding organizations that focus on reproductive justice. Communities that we fund are in the fight of their lifetime. And the only thing that will really change that outcome is grassroots organizing that works, that reaches across issues, and that stands in solidarity with other movements. So that means that when there are attacks on immigrants, on Muslims, on working people, on women, on LGBT people, that nobody is standing alone. And we as funders can create the conditions to ensure that organizations can actually stand up with each other. And lastly, I'll just share around funding work that directly challenges white supremacy. So after the election, we heard a lot of efforts to explain what happened and why there was a right-wing backlash. Many people blamed the economy, which is a convenient scapegoat, except for the inconvenient fact that Black, Latino, and Native American people, three of the groups that are hardest hit by the economic situation, all voted against Trump. A lot of people blamed gender oppression and sexism, but this doesn't explain why 52% of white women voted for Trump, and while the majority of women of color and men of color voted for his opponent. At some point, we need to talk about the centrality of race and specifically white supremacy and the role that it played in this election and how white supremacy is operating under the current administration's executive orders, appointees, and decisions. And we cannot afford to ignore white supremacy anymore. But we can't dismantle white supremacy if the majority of organizations that we are funding are white-led. Organizations that have little track record of standing in solidarity with communities of color, organizations that lack a racial justice analysis, and that are afraid to talk about white supremacy or race. For funders, this means that we may need to take a good look at our knee-jerk reactions. It can be tempting as progressive funders to move resources away from grassroots organizations to double down on big national organizations that are often white-led. These organizations offer the allure of scale and impact. And while I'm not suggesting that we not fund national organizations, they have a very important role to play in our movements, we also have to redefine what we mean by scale and impact in this time. And I mean here, in this current climate, because of the way things are at the federal level, progressive change is going to be harder in the coming years. But there are opportunities at the local and state level to move progressive change. And it is important to support organizations that have been organizing in these contexts for a very long time. For Groundswell, we've seen a lot of these organizations are led by people of color, specifically for us, women of color and transgender people. So national organizations play a critical role in the moment, but they really can't reach some of the communities that these local organizations can play. So for us, we really feel that organizations that are best poised to bring together diverse movements to organize and ensure wins that we can see in the next few years are the ones that are already working at the intersections and that are already being led by those who are most impacted.
Thank you. I'm not keeping everyone to time limits because things are interesting. So I'll make sure everyone gets to ask questions and I'll keep them. This mic isn't working? Okay, I guess I have to be like in my mouth, right? Greg, can you pick up from there, please?
Yes, and I think I'm going to reflect a lot of what you just said. So three points I want to make. One is, I think we misrecognize the current moment as sort of a populist moment. I think we have to think about the continuity of what has occurred. And that for 30 years, as Tony Judd, the late historian, said, we've made a cult of material self-interest. Who is here is above 50 years old. You know, if you remember Reagan and Thatcher, the idea that greed is good and that the attacks on the welfare state began 30 years ago when I was graduating in high school. And so the idea that we're seeing a new assault on the sort of structures that tie us together as brothers and sisters is absolutely false. And the idea that we've been making sort of inexorable progress for the past 30 years is also another myth we have to sort of disabuse ourselves of. If you look at the structures of inequality that have sort of risen through both Democratic and Republican administrations, you know that to be true. It's interesting. I had dinner with somebody who many people in this room know, Deborah Peterson-Small, used to be the policy director of Drug Policy Alliance. And we had a small dinner and we were talking, and I was saying, you know, Deborah, I feel like I'm in the middle of an ocean. I don't know what to do. I'm just terrified about what's happening, and I'm just growing, and I don't know where the shore is. And she looked at me and she said, don't you have any clue about that's the sort of path that I've been treading for the past 50, 60 years, and that the struggle has never been over or anywhere near completion for communities of color. And, you know, if we think everything was different before Trump was elected, think about Ferguson and the police violence we saw over the past 2 years on our national TV. So let's not make this the populist moment that Trump represents. Let's take it as a sort of a capitulation of progressive ideals, which basically started with Reagan and Thatcher and led us to Bill Clinton and welfare reforms. Did you remember that? Glass-Steagall. I mean, all of the what was wrought in November was the culmination of 30 years of work, right? The other thing is, for all this talk about populism and a left populism and progressive ideals, we love to be technocrats, right? For all our smacking down Donald Trump as sort of a know-nothing president, and they don't know anything about health and the environment, we perhaps too much faith in it. And this leads me to the conversation about investing in people. I teach a class up in New Haven, and we've personally done various projects, from drug pricing to Zika and reproductive rights, to maternal health among African American women in Georgia. And we had a young man named Julio Lopez from Make the Road, Connecticut, come and talk to our students today. And he said to a bunch of Yale students, the first thing I want to teach you is that you don't know shit. Right? So if you're going to work with communities, you're going to have to give up the cult of expertise that you were trained, you're all highly trained professionals that know better than the person on the ground what's needed. And if we're going to do that, it means reorganizing philanthropy, right? I know OSF well. Kasha Malinowska Semper came to me in 2000 and said, oh, all the stuff you did with ACT UP and TAG, come do it in Eastern Europe, and, you know, and unmoored sort of the work we did from our home in New York and sort of exported around the world. It's time to come home, okay? Mm-hmm. It's time to come home, and it means that OSF's work on health, which is largely international, needs to come home. I work on health, right? What am I thinking about right now? About emergency room visits in Detroit, Michigan, post-executive order. I don't know what the answer is going to be, but I'm curious to know if Arab American and Muslim Americans are having deleterious health outcomes based on the stigma and discrimination associated with the executive order and all the pronouncements that we've just talked about. Immigration health. We know from immigration raids way before Trump that when immigration enforcement actions rise, healthcare visits go down. Well, baby visits, dialysis, anything you can think of, right? Substance use. You know, I was talking to people some of the people in the audience said we want to do a LEAD program in New Haven. You know, who knows if it's going to be good or bad, but guess what? They're planning to get a DOJ grant so we could pilot a LEAD program in New Haven. Guess what? New Haven's a sanctuary city. So we are now ineligible for any of these DOJ grants. So I've been trying to figure out how to make sense of what's happened over the past few months. And part of it is everything old is new again. And it's interesting, you know, we're having a civil disobedience training in New Haven in a couple of weeks, and who are the people who are coming to do it? It's friends from ACT UP, E.C. Craig and Lex. And there's a big rise in resistance, some of the groups that have appeared in New York for the past few months. It's a bunch of old ACT UP people and some new ones. But the point is that we need to go back to our roots in community organizing and civil disobedience and civil resistance and stop being the experts, investing in sort of more policy papers and more think tanks and more workshops. And for philanthropists, I think it's very difficult to say you're going to give money to Make the Road, Connecticut, right? You're working in Bridgeport with undocumented immigrants, and this is a long-term commitment they're making. You're not going to get, you know, a deliverable at the end of 6 months or at the end of a year. you're going to make a long-term commitment to communities across the country. And so that's where sort of the past few months have led me, is that think of this as a continuous sort of wave of structural violence that's been going on for 30 years against many different communities, LGBT communities, communities of color, women. Two is stop investing in a culture of expertise delinked from working with communities. Expertise has a role in contact and being informed by what communities see happening around them, but it does no good as sort of an abstract theoretical notion. And coming from university, it's hard to say. People don't want to hear that. And the other thing is you're going to have to, it's going to be a culture shift for people at OSF and other philanthropies to sort of say, we're going to have to do things differently and take some of the work we've pioneered around the world in open societies and helping marginalized populations and bring it home. So that's where I'd be.
Thank you. And last but not least, harm reduction.
Hi, how are you? First thing I want to do is I want to thank OSF for putting together such a wonderful event. I'm a little bit more on the informal side, so bear with me. So at some point in time when you want to ask questions later on, if you want to like just redirect something and like just channel it a little bit more directly, that would be fine. I'm going to start by saying that like any form of traveling to a different location, and I just came to New York City just recently, I have to tell you, my timeline was just a little bit behind. So I don't think I realized at this one particular moment that I was actually sitting in New York City. And it didn't hit me until Elizabeth mentioned about North Carolina being one of those many states that hasn't passed Medicaid expansion. And then it just became totally aware to me that I'm in a place right now where you may not recognize the situation that we're actually enduring in the regional South at this particular point in time. So I'm going to, as a tribute to Broadway live shows, I'm going to go totally off script. So that's why I may need refocusing. I'm basically just gonna now just say things that are more so just off the cuff of my head. First thing I'd like to start is, my background was read a little bit earlier. I'm a retired detective sergeant from New York City Police Department. My last few years I worked primarily with organized crime control unit bureaus in doing narcotic operations. Why I bring this up? Simply because I'm doing advocacy right now that revolves solely around harm reduction models and techniques, and basically around overdose prevention, the opioid crisis that we're looking at. As far as talking about populist components, I'm not going to do it because I exist in a red state. So my state had a multitude of counties. That is one of the contributing reasons as to why the administration that we have right now exists. So the populist movement actually exists very, very strongly in North Carolina. But I'm going to make the counter argument and just show you why as to how things can change. Because we do effective advocacy in North Carolina, in a red state, and I think it's significantly important. The organization I work with is called North Carolina Harm Reduction Coalition. It is a grassroots advocacy, services development, project development, coalition building unit that basically addresses people that are vulnerable to drug use, sex workers, gender discrimination, people in the LGBTQ community. So basically we're heavily involved. The most important thing that you need to know about harm reduction is the fact that we are attempting to improve health, promote health through a very, very dignified means by meeting people where they're at. In other words, we don't ask people to basically say, well, at any particular point in time, if you're doing something that's more so illegal or something that's a risk behavior, we want to mitigate the risk. We want to lower the negative consequences by saying, well, we're not expecting you to stop doing what you're doing, but what can we do as a means of basically just minimizing those risk factors, which may include things like condom distribution or establishing syringe exchange programs and the like, which is what I want to get to. North Carolina, over the last 3 years, what we've done is we've actually enacted three major laws. One of them is something which is called a decriminalization of, or partial decriminalization of syringes, which basically means that if you're in possession of a syringe, you won't be prosecuted for that particular offense if you let the officer know that you have this. We've been involved with basically implementation, passing of laws for the 911 Good Samaritan laws, which basically means that if there is an overdose victim, which once again is a public health issue, there's an overdose victim, basically the caller that's making that call to save that life won't be prosecuted for that particular offense. Neither will the victim of that particular overdose be prosecuted. We've implemented naloxone, or the passing a law where naloxone can be used by first responders, and primarily what we actually stressed and emphasized was the use of naloxone Narcan by law enforcement personnel. For those of you that don't know what naloxone is, basically it's an opioid antagonist that basically reverses the effect of an overdose. In other words, another number one symptom of an overdose is basically respiratory despair. Naloxone is basically going to return the ability to breathe for that particular individual. And then most recently in this past year, the law that we passed was syringe exchange. Now, I'm rattling this off because I kind of want you to feel this stew at the same time. Little carrots, little beef, little potatoes. And I want you to understand that I'm saying that this is taking place in this red state. All right? So the question is once again, we put to this populist conversation and say, well, if this is the population of people, and if the motives and the objectives are about the people, and the people voted for an administration that says we're about the people, well then how is it that we're moving through with these conversations and getting it through? Now, I have a phenomenal executive director, his name is Robert Childs. Just called a shout out. You know, so a little joke. He'll appreciate that. And he does a phenomenal job of actually just redirecting purpose and direction as far as where we're going, as far as this opioid crisis and where it actually stands. Now, what's significant about the South, which is entirely different from being in New York, is the Southern region currently right now represents the epicenter of the HIV/AIDS virus. 9 of the top 10 states in the country are in the Southern region states. Coincidentally, if you just follow any particular data trail, you will also see that most of those states do not have Medicaid expansion. So once again, we have a problem and we're not taking care of the problem. Now, what harm reduction does is, it doesn't immediately eliminate the problem, but it starts to promote health issues, and it starts to create dialogues with people within those communities with those vulnerabilities and problems where these issues can now be addressed a little bit better. Now, the significant thing here, and I think this is the tricky thing, if someone was to ask me why, how do you do this? So I'm going to avoid that question for later on. So I'm saving, I'm going to take more time to save time.
Okay.
But I'm going to give it on the short. What we've done is we've absolutely recognized the importance of how we create advocacy strategies. And one of the most important things, and I'm hopefully not going to offend anyone in the room, and I do have to say this before, I'm going to preface it by saying that the objective, the result that you get sometimes, could be more important than the means in which you go after that particular result, okay? So what we've done is we've created very, very, very conservative partnerships, very, very, very Republican partnerships. Now, once again, we're looking at the administration that we have, and these are technically the people that we're partnering with, all right? So when we promote advocacy opportunities, we're going to use a language, our values, where we may say things like pro-law enforcement, or pro-life, or cost savings, things that are much more along the lines of like more conservative way of thinking. You know, it's important when you do lobbying legislative efforts that whoever's sponsoring your bill matters. The person that's sponsoring your bill is very important. Our sponsors, our champions, have been very, very Republican, conservative sponsors. Now, I'm gonna stop there to say, the question there will be, well, why? And this is where, and I know we're going to talk a little bit more on it, but this is where the conversation of where a lot of what we're talking about right now is going to be handled, whether we choose to handle it or we don't, because the opioid crisis in our country right now is very, very real. The problem that we have right now is real. So there are going to be decisions that are ultimately going to be made, whether we choose to actually cognitively make it on legislative lines or community lines or whatever, they're going to have to be done. I can tell you a conversation I had earlier today out of the Senate office of West Virginia in Washington, D.C., where basically it is acknowledged in their office that something happened on Friday. They also acknowledged that if there was a second round of what happened on Friday, everything pertaining to the conservative side of the Republican Party and the Freedom Caucus and the like would be a dismissed point of view. The only thing that's going to be significant moving forward is what the constituents need. So when I heard that earlier, I said, well, there's something to that. But then again, later this afternoon, some of you probably know, in the state of Kansas, Medicaid expansion was just passed. And it's more than likely probably going to be vetoed by the governor. But I think what we're seeing is we're starting to see a move where people are basically saying right now, you know, what is in our best interest? What exactly do we need? How exactly do we need to take care of ourselves? Is it a good thing if hospitals are closing down? All right? We have an opioid crisis where people are falling out in the street and dying. So why are we doing these things that are basically working as an opposition to the main objective, which is basically making people better, keeping people safe? Furthermore, the biggest thing that we do, and I've heard two comments about law enforcement, you know, whenever I hear commentary on Black Lives Matter, it just requires me needing a lot more time because it probably requires a lot more conversation so that there's a mutual balance that can be found somewhere. You know, there's merit in the argument on both sides, but one of the conservative things that we do, or the Republican things we do, it actually is a means of getting this legislation passed for these harm reductive measures that I mentioned is we ally with law enforcement. We basically take a public health argument of basically what is it like not only to remove a syringe off of someone and make them safer because they're not using the drug, but the argument becomes, well, what happens if you're stuck by that syringe? And how exactly do we address this? So I can tell you that working with conversations with individuals in the LGBT community, actually a specific trans group earlier today, and also just legislative means with problems that they're having in Indiana, where the argument becomes where if at some particular point in time, legislatively, someone says, well, we don't particularly agree with what you're saying, we don't want to do it, we don't want to listen to these changes you want, we don't want syringe exchange programs, we don't care about public health. Well, the question is, the administration said that it does want to support law enforcement. So let's change the argument, let's change the discussion, let's change the dialogue, and say, forget about the public health end of this. Let's view it from the public safety end. Basically, if you implement the syringe exchange programs, your needle sticks will go down by 66%. Is that something you would be interested in? So there's various ways of actually, even in these red states, even in populist environments, basically present arguments and discussions that are ultimately going to lead to getting you to where you want to go. I'm just going to finally close, only because I did hear it before. It's about a LEAD program. That's a travesty that basically that, you know, because of the DJ, Department of Justice money, that you can't move forward with the LEAD program. Just to be specific on what a LEAD program is. The LEAD program is, it stands for Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Programs. It's a pre-booking program that, in essence, rather than arresting someone on a low level, like let's say narcotic offense or sex work offense, basically what they've done is they're redirected. They're redirected to a program where there is an intake process will subsequently lead to some type of casework help. And the casework help may include anything from food to residential placement to drug rehab to job placement, whatever it is that brought them into the, put them in the direction of the police. The program is designed basically circumvent that. So we're not filling up our justice systems with the rest. In this particular instance, that was a perfect example where the government side identified a safe zone location, monies can't go there, the LEAD program won't be in. LEAD is moving rapidly through our country. We implemented the first one, my organization, North Carolina Harm Reduction, placed the first one in the state of North Carolina, which is the fourth in the country, in Fayetteville, North Carolina Police Department. Currently, right now, we're looking at Statesville PD, we're looking at in Hanover County, which is Wilmington PD. So it's moving. The city of Philadelphia has adapted it, the city of Atlanta has adapted it, LA is looking at it, it's moving. These are changes that are taking place in the country. So before we go total doom and gloom as far as the overall direction of where public health is going and the moves that we're going to make and where this administration is going to take us, some of the directions, especially since they failed in their first attempt, some of the directions that they want to take us in, they're not going to be simply able to go because now the fight is a little bit easier because they've lost in the first battle.
Great. So. Thank you. Well, I'm going to kind of start some discussion here and I'm going to throw it open to questions. But my big question to everyone, you know, I spent a bunch of years writing a series on healthcare costs, then writing a book, and I heard from thousands of people on the ground who were unhappy, sometimes with public health, sometimes with their private health, and their big question was, especially given all we're talking about, get the people on the ground involved, was what can I do? You know, what can I do? How can I get involved? One thing that really blew me away about the Women's March was to see the diversity of groups that came together to
to see common ground. And one thing I don't see in healthcare is that kind of unifying force. So my first challenge, and one thing after I wrote this book, and this will be my next crusade probably, is to start an online group called like We the Patients, to let people get involved, whether their disease is, whether they have mental health issues, because I think one of the reasons, look, there are, four big insurers in this country, and hundreds of disease groups, each of which works for their own, and there's been a kind of divide and conquer philosophy that I think the pharmaceutical world has used very well. You know, they ally with disease groups from their drug, and instead of people seeing themselves as having a common issue, they see themselves as, if you give money to my drug, you're not, if you give money to their drug, it's not going to go wrong. So I think my challenge to everyone on the panel is like, how do you get people involved? How do you, I can start my website, but, it has been a kind of top-down approach to healthcare. And I think both the Clinton Health Plan, the ACA, you hear it debated in Washington in these theoretical terms, then you see how it plays out on the ground. There's a pretty big divide.
So we're working on drug pricing in our clinic, and we've been working with groups in Maryland and Connecticut. First of all, how do you get people involved? Go back to community organizing. There's just no other way around it. It just, you don't get people involved by funding big national NGOs or big state NGOs. You're going to have to get down to the grassroots. That being said, on drug pricing, it's very hard, because guess who funds most of the patient groups in the United States? The New England Journal and JAMA both have had articles where 80% of patient groups are funded by the drug companies. Maryland just passed the price gouging bill last week. The Connecticut bills went down in flames, and all of a sudden the language in the bills were kind of vaguely like somebody talked to a former rep. No, seriously.
No, I'm sure it's
not. I'm not talking out of school, but the major lobbying group is like, it's a little bit itchy about the idea of like organizing patients. I'm like, what's the downside of like bringing people in to sort of talk about these issues from very personal perspectives? And I think there's a reticence among people to do that sort of on the ground work, which we've heard in North Carolina and other places have been very successful. So I think you gotta let go and give in to the idea that we need to do community organizing on all our issues across the issues if we're gonna make any sense.
I'll just briefly share that in talking to our grantees after the election about what their main priorities were, a number of our grantees were really focused on the Affordable Care Act and defending it, particularly talking to their bases and constituencies in local and state contexts to really get them active. So for example, Raising Women's Voices is partnering with over 30 regional coordinator organizations that have connections to local communities and that actually are engaging people who are patients and who are just people in the community to actually stand up and think about healthcare and actually take action. So I would agree with you that it really is about supporting community organizing that's led by people at the grassroots who can really reach communities that the national organizations sometimes can't.
I agree with that completely. And I think one of the reasons that we've had the surge in people speaking out in the Planned Parenthood battle specifically is that people have been to Planned Parenthood. They know what they're talking about. And I think so much of healthcare debate can get so abstracted and distinct from people's lived experiences. And I think it's actually, again, to get to this importance between sort of popular experience versus the policymakers pushing an agenda. I do think I've been at Planned Parenthood for almost 7 years now. I've been through many a fight, and each time I think I'm struck by the sense that those sort of pushing an agenda that would cut out women's health care from whatever equation you're talking about seem surprised by the reaction. And I think it's that those are the same people who have not probably been to a Planned Parenthood and received health care but we know that millions and millions and millions of people across the country viscerally know that experience. And I guess to me that's what's missing in other aspects of the healthcare conversation is how do you connect the dots when you're talking about programs that are named different things at different levels and so on. And so to take it to a very meta level, I do think, you know, there's a core democratic process aspect of this. And, you know, Greg, as you were talking, I was struggling a little bit, as you said, you know, the technocrat piece. And I'm like, no, but facts matter. And we need expertise and you know, defend the long. but I think you said it well by, you know, technocrats absent community input is where you really see that fall apart. And I think, you know, at a meta level, we are in an era where, you know, the idea that you don't have pure fact is, that no fact can really be true, it makes a conversation about healthcare very, very difficult.
But this is why I really think we need to get to patient experience, because people may not know that the ACA is different than Obamacare, but they know what happened when, you know, their daughter had an unplanned pregnancy and couldn't find a provider to, people know their own experience, whether they're well-educated or not. And what struck me is, hey, I'm writing for the New York Times with my series, and it was mostly, you know, well-educated, well-insured, but the comments came from all these people who just knew it was someplace they could tell their story. It was outside the firewall, so, you know, they could just comment and leave stories, and it was really wrenching. And you know, I felt like, they felt like people in Washington weren't listening to what their experience was, and all of this complicated stuff, you know, with the navigators and deductibles, and they just, you know, their issues were so much more kind of on the ground, bread and butter. So,
yeah, thanks. And I agree with so much of what's been said, and I hope it doesn't sound pedantic to say that we need a popular movement for the right to health in this country, but not a populist movement for the right to health. And let me explain what I mean by that. I think Nat answered the question of what that movement needs to look like. It needs to be built on the foundations of community organizing. It needs to be built on patient stories. It needs to be intersectional. It needs to be connected to racial justice. But I do think it needs to reject many of the features of this right-wing populism, whether it's new or not, that we see. I think it needs to, as Chloe's saying, work through the democratic process. I think there is a role for technocrats. As much as I totally agree that we have overly romanticized evidence and it doesn't persuade people, I was thrilled when the Congressional Budget Office pointed out what, you know, long live the technocrat. You know, we need them, they're part of our democracy. And I say this because we have seen examples of dictators advancing the right to health. And that's not what we want. I mean, the architect of the famous 30 baht scheme in Thailand was the same architect of the spate of extrajudicial killings against people who use drugs, and was basically the Berlusconi of Asia. That is not what we want. We want the right to health in a democratic way.
And Jonathan, can I challenge your dark view? because I guess what I'm always thinking about, you know, I feel like in a weird way you've let the Tea Party and what became of them hijack the term populism and turn it into a dirty word. Do you see an analogous but left-wing progressive version of the Tea Party? Do you see potential for that emerging at this moment in time?
Sure, and by the way, I'm loving the allegation of being dark. I've never been called dark. So I'm going to rise. It's so great for my cred. And so loving it. Sure. I mean, I think you saw it with Bernie Sanders. Absolutely. I'm still not sure. And yeah, I think we can agree. I mean, Trump, Brexit, Le Pen, Orban. I mean, they're giving populism a really bad name. But I also think that at the end of the day, populism is not a coherent ideology. It's a stance. It's sort of what you package your ideology in, and it can be dangerous on both ends of the spectrum.
Okay. Well, and I would just say, I do think that I would call those more white nationalism than populism, and that's where I do just want to, you know, I think how we're advocating this moment has as much to do with, and I think we've all reflected at this point, how we fight back on the attacks we're seeing in the short term as it does in laying out the vision of the world we see and want to see. And I do think, especially in the conversation of health, where it couldn't be more true, we should reject a nationalist framework and really see ourselves as globally connected as we are. And I think health issues present such a perfect example of how we are globally connected, but certainly not the only way.
And how about nationally connected? I mean, this is a pretty divided country. We tend to view healthcare as kind of a silo from education and childcare and nutrition. You know, there's a wonderful book called The Paradox about how if you look at our overall health spending, that our overall health spending could be less if we viewed it as a kind of all of these things feed into health. I think that's a bad word to use because I was about to say we're working on the implications of a story about the implications of hunger in older Americans. It's a big issue that feeds into health, but we this country see that as, you know, that's a different thing.
Well, I would just say I've been in, every year I watch a series of debates in the appropriations committees in Congress where I hear member after member defend their cuts to family planning programs by saying they're supporting maternal health programs. So, I mean, yes, there's a disconnect.
And Jonathan, maybe working in North Carolina too, maybe you have probably some insight into this. Why do people vote against their self-interest?
That could be a very long answer. But, and sometimes I hate to do it, but there's an elephant in every single room, in the corner of the room. And it's just a matter of what audience I'm around or how comfortable you're going to be with the answer or whatever it's going to be. But the answer is the answer. The dynamic of certain counties that I can travel to in North Carolina or in the South, where there are multiple Confederate flags, large flags flying in the back of trucks. The dynamic of small towns that I can enter into where basically just through, once again, I explained what my past was, so I can sense people, I can feel people. I know what people are telling me without their using their words. It's clear. And to be very honest, and just to make it not so much of a political conversation, but just from my vantage point, since it was directed at me, just really just keeping it kind of real. You know, it was 8 years of a black man in the office of the presidency of the United States. And basically, this was the first opportunity of total empowerment and just revitalization that our nation could have, where people that felt just suppressed and oppressed by the fact that an African American was holding that particular office has an opportunity to speak now, has an opportunity to say something. So at this point, any sensibility, any sense of rationality, logical thinking goes totally, totally out the door. If someone tells me tomorrow that the two kids that I have and my particular double wide trailer is not going to have medical care, and I'm now going to vote for someone to basically say, yeah, we're going to take it away from you. Does it make sense? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. But I'm saying whatever feeling, whatever, we're just coming to a true realization of whatever innate feelings of discomfort and fear that we're ultimately going to have to face. There's not no statistical numbers that aren't reflecting basically where Latino American numbers are going to be, Hispanic American numbers are going to be over the next 20, 30 years. There are fear factors that play in our United States of America and the way they're implemented everywhere. You know, so if I had to say why, I mean, that's probably the weakest answer, but I can't dismiss it from what I truly feel.
And do you feel if they knew?
I know you got something to add, really.
I want to add one little thing to the mix. If they knew that their two kids would lose health insurance by that, did they know that? Did they understand the implications of the vote?
I mean, we can play to socioeconomics and we can play to education and really say do people really, I mean, I've seen some interviews of some people that basically were supporters and I really question like, well, why do we allow everyone to vote? You know, for that matter. You know, so, but, you know, that put aside, we're all American citizens and it is a right, you know. Did they really know? One could say yes or no, but I'm just a firm, having been a victim of hate crimes, having witnessed hate crimes, you know, having defended people in the LGBT community, being a member of the state where my legislative body governor snuck in the middle of the night and passed an HB2 law, you know, watching this state go from blue to red over a series of this 8-year period, which is a buildup of that resentment of that Oval Office. You know, when you see things like this and you've lived this life, and I can characteristically say I did not turn 25 yesterday, so I've had enough years to digest some of this stuff, it just plays to a notion that hate can drive you to do the most foolish things that you would never, ever do.
I mean, look, did anybody read Nixon Land? Or Rick Perlstein? He talked about the expansion. So the 60s were this great expansion of the American sort of welfare state, right? Medicaid, Medicare, everything we prize at social programs came about in the 60s. And what was the tool that Nixon used to go after it? It was the Southern strategy. It was pitting social programs against racial resentment. And it's no coincidence that Donald Trump said, I'm the law, not order president. If this is the Southern strategy coming back to bite us 40, 50 years later. And so if people aren't voting against their interests, we've conflated sort of the expansion of the welfare state with special privileges and special rights. And the fact that President Obama did the greatest post-60s expansion of the welfare state under the ACA, and now is no coincidence that a lot of the ire of the American right is directed at the ACA, which is also sort of a proxy for their feelings about race, which are 40 to 50 years old and are deeply embedded in American society. But read Nixon Land, the story is there.
Want to say one thing, and then we're going to throw it open to questions. So,
sure, I'll just say one thing quickly. Thinking about, I think, why do people vote against their self-interest? I think I've been thinking a lot about the power of progressive movements over the past few years, particularly, I mean, Obama being in president, but being in the White House, but also the strength of the movement for Black Lives, immigrant rights movements, LGBT gains that we've made. I think there actually was a backlash against people being really afraid of, and the right using that to manipulate people to be afraid and to come out to vote. But I also want to emphasize the fact that there was very little focus on the communities that actually historically and traditionally vote for the Democrats. There was very little organizing to turn out the vote in communities of color. And what we saw is that those voters who are just, you know, absolutely able to vote in the interest of all people did not turn out at the high levels that they did in the last election. So for Groundswell, we really think about this a lot. And we have a voter engagement, integrated voter engagement program that supports our reproductive justice grantees in actually building the voter engagement power to be able to not just turn out voters who are unlikely voters, particularly women of color and trans communities, but also to engage those voters not just once a year, not just dropping in once a year and saying, hey, will you come out and vote, but actually organizing those people on the issues that they care about. And we have a number of those grantees who do that work in the South. I was going to mention Women with a Vision does that work in Louisiana. National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health organizes in Florida, Texas, and Virginia, and West Virginia Free organizes in West Virginia. So they're able to organize in red states to really mobilize communities that are really very often ignored by traditional voter turnout efforts. And I think that's a really important thing for us to think about moving forward with elections.
Okay, now I want to make sure we get the audience some time to ask questions. There's some mics there if people want to go up to it. I just want to point out one thing, which has been so striking in this election, is that during the election, we at Kaiser Healthers were looking for sound bites about health or public health in the debates. It wasn't talked about. It just didn't come up. And now that that the election is done, it's all over the place. So why isn't that an election, a voting issue in our country? It wasn't at all, and I think that was the part of the failure to have that public groundswell of people who were clearly suffering all from health problems during the election, but the candidates weren't addressed. So, anyone have questions?
Hello? Yeah, I'm practicing there. This is what I was practicing, but it didn't happen. And as far as white people voting against their self-interest, I don't want to quote it directly, but Johnson had a pretty good quote on it. And Nixon might have happened, but if anyone wants to look up the best quote on that issue, you should look up what Johnson had to say. Anyway, my question is, dentistry tends to be the stepchild, this kind of discussion.
Can you get a little closer to the mic?
I've written about the importance of dentistry in general health and in public health in general, centering around education. And what are the prospects? Medicaid has a dental component, but Medicare has none, and ACA had none, very little. So what are the prospects of incorporating some sort of comprehensive dental care in Medicare and in the future of ACA? The single payer, that failed not only because of the Republicans, because of the Blue Belt Democrats put a stop to single payer in the summer of 2009. So that's my question. What are the prospects for dentistry? Thank you.
I mean, I don't know the answer. I think it's an excellent question, and I think it's absolutely time for that kind of visionary approach. I'm sorry, not optimistic. even in Canada, where we have single-payer healthcare, we joke that Medicare protects you from the neck down. So anything, dentistry, eyes, nose, ears, forget it. So even the precedents aren't very good. But I think, I agree with those who think now's the time to go for broke.
But this is also an economic justice issue. Who read the Barbara Ehrenreich book about interviewing people about not having teeth and being ashamed to go for job interviews? I think if you talk about it, not as about getting your cavity filled.
Well, hunger for the elderly is
directly. No, but I think you talk about it not just as about expanding health insurance to include dentistry, but to say it's an economic justice issue, it's a racial justice issue, and that's the way to do it in my mind.
And I think that's one of the things I was asking about. We have this narrow view of health, and if we're not going to even include teeth and hearing aids, or how are we going to include education and feeding? Got a long way to go.
So this was touched on a little bit, but I think a lot of people felt ignored over the last 4 years and by the Clinton election cycle. And so are there any programs that you're aware of, or do you have any ideas for addressing that problem of people feeling like they've been ignored and locked out, and that's what got us where we are now?
I think that is kind of the heart of the matter, is folks not feeling like, even with the change, that they saw everything they needed to see. And I think this issue of bringing it local and starting and centering people at the heart of movements is the only way to address that. I do think we've had a fundamentally broken political process in the last 8 years. It's also made this. I mean, I think for me, when I look at where we are, you know, in this sort of rise against elitism, you know, you have a block of a political block that for 7 years has railed against the healthcare bill, and in 2 months let it unravel and have no real proposal for what to do next, right? I mean, it's the heart of sort of something that is not working, and it's not based on, you know, the turn towards real people's lives and needs. So I do think this move to be local and heart, you know, ground things in community is the only way to move forward from that.
But we've had a culture that there's the undeserving poor. Bill Clinton gave it, started at the top of the Gulf War one. We have no poverty, no. Democrats and Republicans alike have no way to deal with the poor in the U.S., right? And so if you're in West Virginia or you're in Bridgeport, Connecticut, you're both left out. And both parties really have no agenda to help.
Yeah, and I think one of the things, if there's a silver lining, maybe that it's clear that none of this is going to get resolved in Washington. And a lot of it could be done at a state level. I mean, we're seeing a lot more experimentation with all kinds of health plans, health programs. But part of what you're talking about in North Carolina, people are saying, well, this is clearly not, you know, Washington isn't going to take care of this, particularly now. So I think this kind of local, state, and hyper-local approach could be really promising.
My question is, so I think the bill last week, we saw a bill that sort of came at all of us in the health community, but I think in the next round, in the next attempt down the road, what happens when they come at us and sort of use this divide and conquer tactic again? What happens when they cut deals for the elderly groups or the sort of special disease populations? I think this question is directed at funders who fund advocacy, or who are looking to fund advocacy, but as well as the advocates themselves who sort of have to or take these sweet deals or sort of put me with their members and sort of get these deals placed, and it's hard to turn down, but how do we resist down the road to sort of come together?
I don't fund anything. Not even my kids anymore.
There are a lot of funders in the room, so I invite any of them to respond. I think we're already seeing it. You know, certainly in the area of international development assistance, it's divide and conquer, right? It's pit this against that, HIV against reproductive health, against migration, against, you know. So, and it absolutely has the potential to divide movements. And I think a funding strategy to address that, it involves compromise. And in some ways, it butts up against this idea that funders often fetishize, which is this notion of strategy, right? Well, that's not in our strategy to do that. And well, you know, it may not be in your strategy to fund environmental justice, but the fate of global health and environmental justice are inextricably linked from each other, so you fixate on your strategy at your peril. And I say that with a great deal of humility as a funder that, you know, has not built those bridges at all. And I think we have to be very honest with ourselves about it. So it is going to involve a long process of getting out of silos that we probably don't have time to go through.
And I mean, look, that was even so, you know, you pick off, instead of really producing the best bill possible to get things through Congress, you do a bunch of deals. And I think that's really a dangerous strategy for those of us looking at kind of global.
I will say, just to, you know, play the role of a little bit of an optimist on this panel, I've seen less of that than I was worried about seeing so far. And I think it's because what we're seeing is almost people under shock of of just the onslaught of what is coming down. So I do feel much more sense of impetus to work together, to think collectively about an approach. I do think one of the challenges is in doing the advocacy. I mean, I'll speak on the global side, for instance. You know, all of international assistance is completely on the line. I mean, it is, and I mean, talk about an issue of populism. Like, this is something where the people impacted by this, and it is millions of people's lives, and it is life or death, and very near-term consequences, have no vote in this process. And it is very much driven through a nationalist lens that we should somehow, America first, and we can sort of in our think tank universe talk about how it's all connected, but this notion somehow that we're not part of a global community is I think one of the greatest fallacies we're dealing with. And yet the way to do that is to preserve something called the 150 account. Well, that's really sexy, and it's gonna mobilize people to get out of it. And let me tell you about the 150 account. But it's vital, because if we don't have that, it all collapses. And I think everyone in who works across international assistance understands, if we don't preserve that basic foundation and pot, it's good, but the way we talk about the 150 account and talk about our commitment in this space is to talk about whose lives are saved by HIV programs, women whose lives are saved by family planning, malaria prevention. I mean, you talk about the specifics, but you're fighting for the whole. And I do think that's a challenge, and it has to be recalibrated at every juncture, but it is that that personal level that you can message. You just have to make sure the strategies and advocacy are fundamentally going to be aligned. Now, we're only 2 months in, so let's see where we get on our, are we divided and conquered or not? But I will say that's been less of a challenge than I thought it was.
So one of the places, and again, you were wanted, the place where I see organizing happening that isn't like, this is my issue, is around tomorrow, Mondays in North Carolina. Yeah. And to me, that's the most, and this is pre-Trump. This is like, we're doing this together, and we stand. If you're I'm an HIV activist, but if I cannot stand with people working on immigration and reproductive rights, forget it. You're some sort of weird specialist, I don't know. The North Carolina example is inspiring in many ways, but mostly because it doesn't say we're working on an issue, but we're taking the high ground, and this is what good means. This is what social justice means. This is what the common good means.
One thing that's funder is, I think, after the election, Gronsell's been reaching out consistently to our grantees to ask them, what do you need? How can funders be supportive in this moment? And we actually launched a rapid response fund before the election and didn't actually realize how timely that was going to be. And after the election, we got a lot of requests from organizations wanting to meet with organizations of different movements and actually come together and develop strategy and move forward. So we were actually able to support Native-led organizations across the U.S. That were organizing folks at Standing Rock, but also in different parts of the U.S. and actually coming together to create a national strategy moving forward under the Trump administration and work with people in environmental justice, work with people who are doing work around healthcare access and other things, and actually have those conversations. So I think as funders, we can reach out to our grantees and we can find out, are there people that you wish you could be talking to more? Can we resource you to do that so that you actually don't leave each other behind as you are making difficult decisions moving forward?
I wonder, I would love to see speaking from this, in every community, a community of a movement of people who care about healthcare patients in every, there are kind of these natural organizing structures in healthcare, like called your local hospital system, and everyone who's involved in the same hospital system has the same issues, if not today, then tomorrow, and those systems are all pretty similar in their defects. So there is kind of an organizing structure if we figure out how to effectively use them. Yeah, civil system. That's what it's called, right?
Hi, my name is Alma Shabik, and so I worked with the New York Muslim Voter and Information Club prior to when the 2016 elections happened, registering over 100 Muslims. And one of the things is that, like, we discussed a lot today about healthcare and how the political systems that are intact, how they have a direct impact upon how it affects the dynamics of providing healthcare. But it's just so difficult sometimes to even get people who are qualified to get registered to vote. And in addition to that, they're not really informed about what they're getting themselves into. They're not really aware of how it's more than just a Democratic and Republican party. And other points that were made revolving around how we are not investing in these communities is very prevalent because, for example, me, I was working with them, right? So I was getting paid, but I'm expected to like recruit so many volunteers when in reality they would be doing the same work, you know, as me. And I know that other, you know, organizations where it's not people who have the language skills, for example, like I speak Urdu, and I don't need training to be able to have a conversation like that. Or I don't need training to express my personality and share, you know, thoughts in having a conversation of how essential and critical it is for us to vote. But like even me, I don't know every single thing about like the Green Party or the POP. Like this is the first time I'm hearing about populism. What's it called? And you know, like you know, we're raised with the knowledge of only about like a Democratic and Republican party. So like, what really can we do to be informed about like everything, you know? And it's and reaching like that, because I feel like even I don't know, and I'm in like a position where you would say, yeah, like you know, you registered over 100 voters or whatever it is, but like, have I, like when I could have used the opportunity to really educate them and, you know, do so much more, but there's not even like resources and like the information that I should be like knowing is not there out for me.
And I think that's something that's useful to hear for us. I mean, I would do my plug that for healthcare, you can be Kaiser Health online. I think, you know, what were you doing this through an organization? And what would have, you know, there are a bunch of funders up here, what would have helped you be more effective in that role? So that's what I think everyone needs to hear.
Yeah. So,
But for the webcast, if you could step to the microphone, people can't hear you online.
Oh, go back to the microphone.
You have to go to the mic. Yeah, come up and get
it. So, well, I also like volunteer with the World Science Festival annually. It's an annual festival. So one of the things they do is like they have a very simple like handbook. Something so simple as a handbook where we're even training people and investing in them so that they're educated. Like for example, all I got when, you know, I was hired is like, so you, what are you gonna do? Is you gonna talk to my, by the way, like I respect this person so much. But you know, but it's just like you're having a conversation and there's not like educational components to really prepare me and for me to think critically. Every single like question I would be asked on the spot is just because like out of my own knowledge, you know, and I'm not being properly trained for that. So training people before they are actually on the, you know, how do you say, front lines, yes. On the front line of getting people registered to vote and not like I look like a trustworthy person, so you know, some people will ask, so who would you vote for? And I will be like, you know, listen, this is what I can get. And it's such a heavy, like, responsibility, you know? And I feel like I wasn't saying the right answer. I could have, like, you know, had a better discussion. So handbooks, I think is one. And then also, like, not expecting everybody, like, volunteer work is great, you know, but then I question, like, even me, like, although I know I can easily recruit people who would be willing to volunteer just because they respect me a lot, I don't think it's fair that I'm getting registered, people registered to vote, and I'm getting paid, and then I'm like, oh yeah, you go into volunteer work. Like, what, I'm not, like, as a human, we're equal. Like, we're, it doesn't matter what their age is.
Well, and I think this is the kind of grassroots help and organizing and focus that everyone, you know, that you look like you're ready to say something.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, thank you for sharing your experience. And I think for me, this just really underlies like how important it is to be investing in particularly communities of color-led organizations, women of color-led organizations that are going out and talking to communities about voting, about other issues, right? And to invest in them, not just to do that voter engagement work, but to do their ongoing work of training people, getting volunteers involved, and then giving them resources so they can actually staff up. So that in the next election, we're actually seeing record turnout of communities of color because we're actually reaching the people that are not being reached, right? And that is actually going to take resources, and those organizations need funding to do that. So I think that, thank you for just bringing that to this room. It's such a great example of what's needed.
And I think that's a perfect way, I could talk about this forever, but to end our session. And Alyssa is going to come give us a goodbye message.
That and makes it sound much more interesting.
She's going to send us all home with missions, right? What to do next.
Right. So I just want to say thank you to our wonderful speakers and our wonderful moderator, and to all of you for coming out on this rainy night. I think it's been really heartening. To hear about strategies and ways of moving forward. And at the risk of forcing a metaphor, I understand that actually the sun is supposed to come out tomorrow. So we can take that with us to counter our dark vision. But no, really, thank you. And I think these are the difficult issues that we need to be tangling with. Also, Jonathan reminded me, do a little plug. This has been live streamed, but it will also be available on the OSF website, so share it with your friends.